Welcome once again to Meet the Press. Our guest today is the Undersecretary of State, Mr. Douglas Dillon. He is the second-ranking officer of the State Department, and he serves as the acting secretary when Secretary Herter is absent from Washington. Secretary Dillon is leading the administration's fight for approval by Congress of President Eisenhower's $4.1 billion foreign aid program. The House of Representatives voted on Friday to reduce the appropriation by about $600 million. The anti-American demonstrations in Japan and the cancellation of the president's visit have provided ammunition for both sides in the debate over the value of the mutual security program. Secretary Dillon has directed the State Department's economic activities since 1957. Prior to that time, he served 4 years as our ambassador to France. And now seated around the press table, ready to interview Secretary Dillon, are Frank Burkholzer of NBC News, Ernest Lindley of Newsweek magazine, Marcus Childs of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and Lawrence E. Spivak, our regular member of the Meet the Press panel. Now, Mr. Secretary, if you're ready, we'll start the questions with Mr. Spivak.
Mr. Secretary, the situation in Japan is being used by critics of the mutual security program to prove that we can't win friends with money and that there is no reason why the mutual security program shouldn't be cut. How do you answer those critics?
Well, in the first place, Mr. Spivak, the point, the objective of our mutual security program is not to win friends with money and never has been. What we are attempting to do is to help people who are struggling to advance their political and their economic stature to develop societies that will be firm and will have the strength to carry themselves on their own. That's a hard and difficult job, and we have to expect ups and downs in the process.
Well, aren't we also spending a good part of our mutual security funds for military purposes in order to add to our own security and the security of the free world?
That is right. About a little less than half of the funds which we suggest are for military assistance, which go to the countries around the rim of the communist bloc in NATO, in CETO, in the Far East, countries who are in the forefront right on the borders of the communist world.
Now, Mr. Secretary, but what went wrong in Japan? Didn't we spend enough money there, or didn't we spend it wisely enough?
No, I don't think there's any connection between the money that was spent in Japan. Actually, in Japan, the economic recovery has been remarkable. There has been very little in the way of foreign aid to Japan since the occupation ended. There has been some military assistance as Japan has started to rebuild her defense forces. What happened in Japan is totally apart from the foreign aid program and was a reflection of the fact that the people of Japan, some of them have a deep pacifism, and they were led astray, way astray, by a very militant, forceful communist minority.
Mr. Secretary, one more question. The House bill, the House Mutual Security bill, is close to $600 million less, I believe, than the president has asked for, about $580 million. Can you tell us how that cut is going to affect your expenditures in the Far East?
Well, this is going to hurt us very considerably. The House, the original cut by the House Appropriations Committee was $800 million, a reduction of $400 each in military assistance and in all the economic programs. As a result of the action on the House floor, half of the military assistance reduction was restored. So now we have a reduction there of only $200 million from the $2 billion request. The economic funds, none were restored. As a result of that, we will be extremely short. There will be more emphasis possibly on the military side of the program, which is barely adequate, but certainly the economic side will be inadequate, and there will be inadequate funds throughout the Far East.
Mr. Childs.
I know, Mr. Secretary, one of your continuing concerns is to free the channels of trade. Now, in the light of what's happening in Japan, many Americans are saying we should take reprisals by cutting down our purchases of Japanese goods. Do you think this is a right thing or a right response to this thing that's happened in Japan?
Not at all, because I think we have very real and solid relationships with Japan. One of the things they're based on are our close economic relationships. Japan is now our second largest trading partner, second only to Canada, and we are Japan's largest. We exchange goods about $1 billion a year in each direction. And certainly, because of the actions of a small minority directed from Moscow, this is no time for us to take any action that would hurt the mass of the Japanese people.
But I believe they are now selling more to us a little bit than we're selling to them, and you're having some industrialists, and you're having unions like the Textile Workers Union, who say that in view of the very low wage paid in Japan, the competition is unfair. Now, isn't there some basis in fact in this criticism, Mr. Secretary?
Certainly it's true that the Japanese wage scale is much lower, and that if they so desired to concentrate on certain areas, they could produce certain things, such as textiles, far cheaper than we can, and could flood our markets. The Japanese have been aware of that, and we have worked with them, and they have taken action, a good action, to control their exports so that they will not disrupt markets, not go too heavily into any one area. In the field of textiles, they've imposed restraints upon their own exports, which have worked very satisfactorily, and there has been no increase in those exports over the past few years.
On this matter of balances, I know that your colleague in the administration, Mr. Anderson, the Secretary of the Treasury, is very concerned that when you add in the foreign aid and our other outlays in that respect, you have an unfavorable balance of about $3.5 or $4 billion. Does this concern you at all? I know you used to be a banker.
Well, certainly we can't keep on with unfavorable balances of $3.5 to $4 billion for any length of time. I don't think we're going to. Certainly the best way out of this is to increase our exports. And that is just what we are trying to do. We have an administration program to give the push to exports that other industrial countries are doing. And this year, it looks like our exports will be increased, our export surplus be about three times as big as it was last year, so that our deficit, instead of being between $3.5 and $4 billion, would only be somewhat under $2 billion. And foreign aid plays a very small part in that.
Mr. Lindley.
Mr. Secretary, you've been concerned not only by the size of the mutual aid appropriations, but by the restrictions. Did the House on Friday remove all the restrictions that you disliked among those recommended by the Appropriations Committee?
By no means, Mr. Lindley. They did remove two of the restrictions, one of which on the Indus River was particularly important. The most the important remaining restrictions are on the flexibility of handling the program. They have a restriction there which removes from the president all flexibility in handling his contingency fund. Now, this fund was set up, it's less than 5% of the total request, to give him a certain amount of flexibility in a period which runs up to 19 months ahead of the time when the original plans were made. You can't conceive of any business operating with less flexibility than that. Additionally, another thing which is more or less incredible to me, the Congress itself set up an inspector general and controller to root out, ferret out waste and maladministration in this program. They did that just last year. We started to put the organization together last September. It's about together now, and the House, in this appropriations action, cut half of the funds out that are needed to carry on this work, which is designed to to make a better administered mutual security program. The only result can be a less effective action against waste. It's incomprehensible.
Well, how much waste do you think there still is in our mutual security program? Can you make any estimate?
It's impossible to do that. I think there's bound to be a certain amount. I don't think it's large anymore. All of these stories that we read about of waste are generally aimed at incidents that happened 4 or 5 years ago. And even in those cases, it's primarily where estimates were wrong, where it was estimated that a certain project would cost $10 million, and when you got all finished, it cost 15 or 20. There are no cases where the project itself was completely wrong.
Now, Mr. Secretary, the communists, particularly the Soviet Union, has an economic and technical aid program. Do you know anything about the flexibility they have in operation? Do you have any inside information on how they make up their mind where to put the money and what to do with it?
No, but I will tell you one thing. They are extremely flexible in the handling of their technical assistance program, far more than we have ever been, and that is natural because they have the ability to order up a technician on 24 hours notice and tell him to go wherever he may be needed. And this brings me to the third of the restrictions in the present act, which in some ways is the most distressing of all. And that is on our tried and true technical assistance program, which has been based ever since President Truman first suggested on cooperation with the other country, where we work together and plan projects out. The House in this action has said that we cannot do that anymore. We can only put into effect programs which have been listed as U.S. illustrative programs 18 months ahead of time before the other country has even seen them. We are not allowed then to go to the other country. If they have some different idea, we can't accommodate them. We'll have to tell them, no, we have to wait 18 months more until we've asked the House Appropriations Committee if they like that. It makes this a take-it-or-leave-it program instead of a cooperative one.
How large is the Soviet economic and technical aid program in the free world?
The Soviets have been, in the last few years, they've been spending close to $1 billion, or at least committing close to $1 billion a year for economic aid in the free world.
Mr. Burkholzer.
Mr. Secretary, some months ago there were several agencies, including some congressional committees, which criticized the overemphasis of military aid in the foreign aid program. And yet it looks as though the principal cuts have been in economic aid. How do you account for this seeming inconsistency in the Congress?
Well, Mr. Burkholzer, that's a very difficult thing to account for. Of course, I don't think this criticism is a valid one in the first place, because you're talking about two totally different things, like apples and oranges. We need a certain amount of military assistance to provide the security shield behind which development can take place in the countries on the borders of the communist orbit and the countries further behind, which don't need military forces. We also need adequate economic assistance for these countries. Now, what's happened right now is that we've had a restoration in our military funds, which brings them to an area 10% below what we recommended. Our economic funds, there's been no restoration, so they have been cut nearly 20%. And certainly I would hope that the Senate would at least restore the same amount of funds, or at least as much funds in the economic side as the House did on the military side, so that we could have a balanced program when we come out.
Mr. Secretary, you were acting Secretary of State when the U-2 incident occurred, and you were acting Secretary again when the President's trip to Japan had to be called off, and I think maybe you're acting Secretary right now, unless Mr. Herter's arrived back in town in the last minute or two. Do you feel there's any weakening in the decision-making ability of the government when modern diplomacy seems to call for the secretary to be away so much of the time?
No, I don't think there is any weakening, because the full power of decision in the Department of State rests with the acting secretary, whoever he may be, when the secretary is out of town.
One other question, Mr. Dillon. Is it still, going back to the U-2 case, and there's been no responsible official have a press conference since the summit conference, I wondered if I could ask you, is it still the American position that the U-2 flights were justifiable and there was nothing about them that required apology to anyone? Is that still the basic American position?
We certainly don't feel any apology was required, and we think that they were justified for the defense of the free world so that we could know what was going on behind this iron curtain of secrecy, which the Soviets stress is so important. If there wasn't that sort of an iron curtain, these sort of flights would never have been necessary.
Mr. Spivak.
Mr. Secretary, the recent riots in Japan, which forced the cancellation of the president's trip, are being described all over the world as a humiliation to us and as a threat to our position in the Far East. Will you tell us how you view those riots?
Well, I think it certainly was they are a great disappointment to us. We're sorry that the president's trip had to be canceled. There's no minimizing that situation. However, we should not either go into a panic about it, because certainly we are engaged in a life and death struggle which is going to go on for a number of years with the communist system. We can't win every battle. What we are aiming at is to win the war. We always knew, the communists had served notice, that as this treaty progressed, that they would do everything they could to stop it. And they certainly have taken advantage of this, and I think that the final judgment will depend on what happens in Japan over the coming 6 months or a year, how they settle down, how this shock which they have received when mobs really, for a short period of time, took over Tokyo and made it impossible, made law and order really out of the question.
Mr. Secretary, do you think that the situation indicates a serious deterioration in the friendly relations between the United States and Japan, which have existed now for some years?
No, Mr. Spivak, I don't think this has anything to do. This is one of the remarkable things of these riots. Although the communists, who were the small minority, were violently anti-American and tried to give them that sort of a twist, there didn't seem to be any sign of a general anti-American bias to these riots. There were Americans in the crowds all the time, and no one ever molested them. And there was a feeling in the press that it was wrong to Japan to try to bring anti-Americanism into this rioting.
How do you think that this situation affects our leadership, though, in the Cold War?
As I say, the communists have claimed this as a great victory. Undoubtedly, it was a tactical victory for them to have been able to stir up this much trouble in any country, any free country, and all we have to do is to tighten our belts and go ahead and see that we get the benefit in the long run.
Are you saying then that there has been no effect on our strength, our military strength, in the Far East at all?
Oh, there's certainly been no effect on our military strength in the Far East as yet. There would be an effect if this security treaty eventually did not go through. That would have very serious effects, but there's no indication that will not be the case.
Mr. Childs.
Mr. Secretary, Governor Rockefeller, in his challenge to Vice President Nixon 10 days ago, said this to say that 1 month before the 10 Nations Disarmament Conference, there simply did not exist a prepared American position, and that we seem to be no more ready to meet this challenge than to confront sudden accident or crisis. Do you think that's a fair statement?
It's not quite a fair statement, no, because the U.S. position was ready in pretty good detail, more than that, I'd say some 2 months before the conference. But the point is that we had a whole lot of very many studies underway, and we really went at this in depth, and we had all the various background material ready along about the first of the year. In an orderly fashion, that was put together, an agreed plan was developed, and beginning the end of January, which was the only time this was scheduled to begin, we sat down with our allies, and over a period of about 6 weeks or 5 weeks, worked out a joint plan, which was ready some 2 weeks before we actually met in Geneva.
Well, now the Soviets have come up with another disarmament plan. I know you've been conferring with the American negotiator, Mr. Eaton, who's come from Geneva. Isn't there a possibility that while this plan may not offer any real hope for disarmament, that it may win a propaganda victory for the Soviets?
Certainly that seems to be one of the objectives of the Soviets with this new program. We are looking at it very carefully. We are trying to see, to probe, to see what the Soviets mean by some of these proposals, which are always cloaked in words which are ambiguous, to say the least. And we think after it's a thorough discussion that this will not be the case.
Mr. Lindley.
I'd like to return, return to the effects of the recent events, beginning with you two and going through the Japanese episode. What do your diplomatic reports show about the net effect of these on public opinion or governmental opinion in the rest of Asia and Africa? Has it been toward to encourage neutralism or not?
We've seen no effect of that so far at all. Certainly, I think that in Asia, the riots in Japan, the effect of them have been recognized as communist-sponsored, and therefore, since they achieved their limited first objective of preventing the president's trip, they've been looked on as a communist victory. But certainly these countries are becoming more and more aware of the communist menace. Many of them have felt it at home themselves. And I think this is one more place where that has been unmasked. And if we stand firm and go ahead, I don't think there'll be any loss of friendship or respect for us.
Now, recently, two Asian governments of which we had very friendly relationships were overthrown from within, Republic of Korea and Turkey. Do you feel any anxiety about political trends within either of those countries?
None whatsoever. We have very close relationships with the Korean people and with the people of Turkey. We dealt with their governments. We had no differences. These governments were both overthrown for purely internal reasons, questions of internal policy and internal power, and their successor governments in each case have said they have no question about the foreign policy or the relationships with the United States, and we have equally friendly relations with the successor governments immediately.
Mr. Burkholzer.
Mr. Secretary, the other day Dr. Teller spoke to a senior class at the Foreign Service Institute, a class of diplomats, about the nuclear test ban negotiations and said, in effect, that American diplomats have fixed it so that we have to ask Khrushchev for permission to even dig a hole in the ground. What is your general view on the diplomatic approach to a test ban agreement?
Well, Dr. Teller has always felt that we should resume testing, and our views on that are that we're going to make every possible effort to see if we can reach an agreement on a nuclear test ban that would be adequately and carefully controlled. We're still in the process of doing that. I don't know whether it'll be possible or not.
There's a report that Mr. McCone of the AEC feels the Russians have already resumed testing. Do you feel that that's the case?
I don't think there's any evidence of that whatsoever. That's a surmise that anyone can make. Maybe it'd be right or maybe it'd be wrong, but there's no evidence.
Mr. Spivak.
Mr. Secretary, now that the Japanese government has ratified the treaty, do you think we should, too, our Senate should, or do you think we ought to wait until public opinion in Japan comes our way?
No, I think now we should proceed immediately and ratify the treaty in the next day or two.
Mr. Childs?
This administration has put great stress on private investment in foreign countries, but here we have in Cuba hundreds of millions of dollars of American capital being expropriated.
Mr. Childs and gentlemen, I'm afraid we're going to have to let Cuba stand till the next time we get together. I'm very sorry to interrupt, but I see that our time is up. Thank you very much, Secretary Dillon, for being with us.
And Monitor's thanks to Undersecretary of State Douglas Dillon and the members of the Meet the Press panel for an enlightening half hour. The panelists were Frank Bergholzer of NBC News, Ernest K. Lindley of Newsweek, Marcus Childs of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and Lawrence Spivak, the producer of Meet the Press. Now, our usual personal word about here. Yes, this year, the people of America face one of the most important elections of our time. Your fate and mine rests in the hands of the men and women we elect to office in local, state, and federal government. This then is your chance to express your will, to work for the kind of government and the kind of world we all want. It's a glorious chance, but it means nothing if you refuse to accept your precious rights.